Anthony Logan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How is it coming all the way from Grimsby to Dubai?
Yeah, Grimsby feels like a different life ago. There's quite a grit about people from Grimsby.
Set me the scene a bit.
Probably a typical entrepreneur story. Terrible at school, dyslexic, ADHD, you know. I really enjoyed DJing. I started throwing a lot of parties for my friends. We had to design the flyer. Downloaded like an illegal version of Photoshop. Started playing around. Loads of people were getting in touch with me and going, can you just help me out with this? I just really started to get this understanding of like brands. And then I got approached by this guy called Umar. Started a new business called Pretty Little Thing. I was basically the design team to begin with.
Why did you leave?
This was not really my dream to work for like a girls fashion company.
How did Noir Agency come about?
One of my best friends is Steve Barber. I remember saying to Steve, I need to figure some shit out. And then I came up with the idea for Noir.
Any horror stories?
We weren't getting as many clients as we were. We start getting behind on payments for stuff. Then I had this client that tried to sue us and then things got worse.
Guys, Matt Haycock's here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show, where today I've got another fellow Brit with me, all the way from sunny Grimsby, here to living the dream in Dubai. I've got an expert in branding and the blockchain space, Anthony Logan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How is it coming all the way from Grimsby to Dubai?
Yeah, Grimsby feels like a different life ago. So I left Grimsby when I was 17 years old. And then was sort of moving around. I was living in Leeds for a little bit, and then I moved over to Manchester, and then that sort of became my base for the next, 10, 12 years after that.
Do you ever revisit Grimsby?
Try not to.
I used to have a shop there years ago, you know.
Where was that?
I can't even remember. I had a business partner. I mean, we're talking 2005, 6, 7. I had a business partner, and we did discount retail stores. So, you know, just like B&M Home Bargains, that kind of stuff. And Grimsby and those kind of East Lincoln or Northeast Lincolnshire towns were our hunting ground of pilot high, sell it cheap.
Yeah, do you know what? There's a lot of entrepreneurs that come out of Grimsby. One of my friends, she launched a business called My Energy, and that's turned into like one of the biggest like EV companies in the world now. They've really blown up.
Oh, really?
But I think there's quite a grit about people from Grimsby because there's not many opportunities. So you really have to like go and find them yourself, have to become quite a hustler.
Is Sacha Baron Cohen's Grimsby stories, is that not really representative of the true Grimsby?
I mean, he didn't even film it in Grimsby, so I think people were pretty pissed with that. But it didn't really put us on the map for the best things. But yeah, do you know what? Like, it was a nice place to grow up. I grew up in this little village called Kielby. It was pretty chill. We're on the countryside. There was nothing to do, you know. So it was fine when you were a kid, but as soon as you get to like 14, you're just bored out your mind. And I was born in Manchester, so I always wanted to like go back there and like see what the place was about. But yeah, Manchester was a much better place to spend my time, for sure.
Well, look, I want to get into branding. I want to talk about the is it Noir? You were saying Noir Agency. I guess just before we get there, just set me the scene a bit in terms of educational background, you know, childhood interest, you know, what you did that kind of brought you to where we are today.
Yeah, so probably a typical entrepreneur story. Terrible at school, dyslexic, ADHD, you know, all the usual signs for like a young entrepreneur. And I just hated school, to be honest. I really struggled with it. I love playing sports and being with my friends. And I just got to a point where I just thought, you know, I'm never really going to do anything that the teachers want me to do. So I pretty much dropped out of school when I was 16. After that, they kind of like pushed me onto this college course.
Did you have any idea about the future at that point? Like, were you happy dropping out because you're like, well, I'm going to drop out because I'm going to be an entrepreneur or I'm going to do something?
No, I just really didn't enjoy like people telling me what to do, and especially not just people telling me what to do, but people telling me what I couldn't do. So it was always like, you know, if you don't achieve these qualifications, you're never going to be anything. And it just used to really get under my skin when they said that, because I just thought, this is stupid. You know, it's just a piece of paper.
What did your parents do? Or do you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah. So my brothers and sisters are like super educational. You know, my sister's got like 2 degrees, PhD, all the rest of it. So I was sort of like the black sheep of the family. And, you know, it puts quite a lot of pressure on you as well when everyone else is doing stuff. My mum and dad were in like healthcare. So mum worked for the NHS. Dad looked after people with mental health, so I was never really going to go down that path because it just wasn't something that interested me. And then I really enjoyed DJing, so I started throwing a lot of parties for my friends. I was sort of DJing, and as a consequence of that, we'd always have to try and get people to come to these events. So I started, well, we had to design the flyers, so I was like, right, we don't have any money, how are we going to design these flyers? So I just taught myself how to do it, downloaded like an illegal version of Photoshop and started playing around. And eventually it got to a point where loads of people were getting in touch with me and going, can you just help me out with this? Can you make a logo for this? And it was really just like a side hustle while I was DJing. And then it got to the point where all of these other clubs were getting in touch with me and asking me to design all their artwork. And then it was, can you build me a website? And then it sort of just grew from that quite quickly. So I realized that.
And you ended up, were you doing it on your own or do you have any?
Just doing it on my own. But I realized, like, the thing is, when you don't have any money and you find something that can make you money, you just double down on it straight away. So I was like, I can make money from the parties. I can make money from a bit of DJing. But this is actually making me more money because I was charging maybe like £50 a logo or something. And I'd get like 10 logos a week. And at like 17 years old, I was like, this is, you know, I'm a millionaire. Like, it was amazing. So yeah, after that, I just realized I had a skill for understanding how things should look, especially like looking at a brand and how they need to position themselves. And I just remember like driving, it was actually through Grimsby. I remember driving through Grimsby. It's this road called
Freeman Street. That's where my shop was.
So there's this road on the way to Cleethorpes. It's called Freeman Street. And you've just got all of these like, just like proper Grimsby businesses, you know, one man, two man band or whatever, but just all the branding was terrible. And I remember just driving down and thinking, why would you want to go into any of these places? And I was like, if they all just changed their logo on the front, this whole street would feel different. It would be the difference between a high end street and a low end street. Obviously you still got, you know, like the crazy people walking around and all the rest of it. But I just really started to get this understanding of like brands. And then I started to look at other brands and I'm like, what is it that makes people like become so like affiliated with brands? You know, like people are proud to wear Nikes and, you know, proud to show off their Apple laptops. And I'm like, why is that? Can't just be the logo. So I sort of went down a rabbit hole at this point. And
were you starting to try and teach yourself on this as well?
Yeah, and the internet was shit then as well. So it'd take 10 minutes to load a page up. But I was just really interested in understanding what the word branding meant. Because I think if you say it to most people, nowadays they're starting to understand. But wow, like 10, 15 years ago, if you say branding to people, they'd just say, yeah, my logo. Because that's all anyone thought branding is.
And how would you define brand to someone asking today?
I mean, there's so many quotes about this, but it's, I think a really good one that I saw was, it's what other people will say about your company when you're not in the room. It's the way it makes people feel. You know, a logo doesn't make people feel a certain way, but the whole experience is a brand. So like take Hermes, for example, right? People, and Louis Vuitton the same, but people are like very proud to walk around and it's a statement to have like an Hermes shopping bag. You know, to show that you shop there because it's the bright orange. You don't even need to see that logo. If someone put their hand on it, you'd know straight away what that orange is. And I think like that is really what defines a brand, something that lives beyond just the, you know, the name of the company. So
I'm going to totally butcher it, so I won't even try and say it, but I read a good analogy recently as well, where I think it was talking about, for example, you know, Nike and Holiday Inn. And it was basically saying that, you know, if Nike were to go and open a hotel, you would know exactly what it was going to be like when you walked in. You know, you'd know exactly what to expect. Whereas if Holiday Inn were going to go and open a sports shop, you wouldn't have a fucking clue what it was going to be. And that's because even from a hotel perspective, you don't even know what to expect with a Holiday Inn because it's not a brand. It's cheap.
It's a name. That's their brand, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's all you can expect. You know, it's a name above the door. Whereas, you know, with Nike, it's like you said, the way it makes you feel. It's the sound. It's the people attached to it. It's, you know, it's every step of that emotional journey. I think that was a, and I've completely butchered the
I think it makes complete sense.
A fantastic, I guess, you know, very visual or very emotional analogy of what a brand is.
Definitely.
So how did Noir Agency come about? Did this exist back then? Then when you were working?
No, not at that point. So I was really just a freelancer at this stage. So I somehow one of my friends is at like an art college doing like a graphic design degree. And they'd seen all of the things I was doing. So they'd spoke to their tutor and said, look, I know this guy. He's already a really good graphic designer. Is there any way he can come on this degree course? So I go over to, I think it's called like Grimsby Art College or something at that point. So I go over to there and I've got no qualifications. Like I think I had two GCSEs and they were like D's and, you know, didn't have any A levels. And they accepted me on this course. They were like, look, you've got a lot of work. Every so often we'll take one or two people on a year with like exceptional talent and we'll, you know, give you a chance to do this degree. So obviously my mum was very excited. It's like, finally, you know, my son's going to get a degree. I go there, I think I was there 2 days and I was in a lecture and I'm listening to the teacher talk about graphic design and they were like showing you how to do something, but it was wrong. Like, and I knew it was wrong. I was like, why are you doing it that way? So I said like, excuse me, sir, like, why are you doing it that way? That's like the wrong way to do it. And his response was, I'm the teacher, you're the student, you know? And he was like, so why don't you come up here and show us how to do it? So I did, because I was like, you could just do it an easier way. And then he was teaching something else. This was like maybe a couple of hours later. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. And then he said to me, you know, who are you to like question this course? You're here to learn, not to question everything. And I said, well, you know, questioning things is how you learn. And I said, have you ever worked in an agency? And at this point, obviously, he looked pretty pissed off at me. I was like, have you ever worked on any brands? You ever worked in an agency? Like, and he said, no, I'm an art teacher. I said, well, how am I going to learn from you then if you've never done the thing that I want to do? And I just walked out and quit. Then went home, my mum went absolutely crazy and she was like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I'm never going to learn from, I want to learn from people who've done what I want to do. So yeah, then after that, I was like, do you know what? I need to figure this out myself. It doesn't have to be from someone else. And I start looking for like jobs that I can apply for at like, I think there was the Grimsby Evening Telegraph and all these other ones. And they were like 11K salaries for the year. And I went and had these interviews and the graphic designers were rubbish. That, you know, the software was old. And they were just so behind. And I thought, this is, again, not the place where I'm going to actually learn. I'm going to be held back. So I'll just carry on doing my freelance thing. So at this point, you know, I'm DJing. And the problem with DJing is, you know, you're basically partying until 4 a.m. every night and then sleeping, you know, throughout the day. And that kind of has a lot of consequences on the rest of your life because you're kind of always tired in the day. You're basically working nights. And then I was trying to design all these flyers. And I realized I was going to be trapped in Grimsby forever. And that was like my nightmare. So at this point, I was like, right, I'm going to go and have a fresh start and I'll move to Manchester. So, you know, packed up all my stuff, said goodbye to everyone, moved to Manchester. Didn't know one person at this point.
Why did you pick Manchester?
So I was born there originally and my dad's from there. And he's just, since I was a kid, he put United kit on me and he was like, you're a Manc. You know, my passport says Stockport on it. So I was always like, right, I need to go and see what my life would have been like, you know, if I'd grown up in this city. So I get there and I'm like, right, I don't know anyone. And I remember I got like this, I was in Fallowfield and I got a bus into town, stay in this absolute shithole. It was like 30 quid a week, but it was like, I'm there, at least I'm in Manchester. And there was this guy and he was hiring people to work in events. So I was like, right, I know events. Let's just go there and figure it out. And then I said to him, look, I don't really want to like hand out flyers. That's not what I do. I've thrown parties. I've DJed. I can actually design all your artwork. And he's like, we already have a designer. We don't need anyone. So I'm like, right, okay, leave there, go home. Later that night, about an hour, 2 hours later, he rang me and he said, is there any way that we can get you in to actually work on all our artwork? Our designer's not very well. And we have like 15 flyers that need doing. We'll pay you like £200 a flyer if you can do them all within the next 3 days. I'm like, yeah, in, done it. So I do that, make my first bit of cash. And I'm like, right, okay, there's something here. So then I start going around to all of the other clubs like Tiger, everyone else. And I'm like, listen, I can do all your flyers. And I'd created like a package. So it was like, you get 10 flyers for X amount of money. And I went around and pretty much got every single club in Manchester at this point. And then after that, I realized I could charge them more money if I was going to sell them websites as well. And at this time, I didn't have a fucking clue how to build a website or anything. But there was this like website builder where you could kind of do it all yourself without code. So I just used to, you know, do this website builder thing. I can't remember the name of it, but it was like £10 a month or something. And you could literally design whatever you wanted, and started making websites for people and charging sort of £500 to £1,000 to do that. So I was like, right, okay, you know, I've actually got something here. At this point, I'm starting to throw parties myself as well, because I'm like, this is my bread and butter. It's what I know how to do. And I set up this night called La Vida. And I had this idea, it was at a club called Circle, where a lot of the celebs and footballers went. I had this idea that we could just put a catwalk in the middle of the runway. A catwalk in the middle of the club. And it would be like a fashion and, you know, a party. I'm sure they do them all over the place now. But at the time, it was quite new. And then a lot of events were ran on Facebook at this point. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, yeah.
You get a lot of these Facebook invites.
I'm not that old.
So I created like a magazine cover, and I got what would have been influencers then. So all the key people that parted, and I made their face the cover of the magazine. And it would say like Levido at the top behind their head, like a normal like Vogue magazine would be. And then the text on the side was like the entry. And so like £5 entry or whatever it was. Yeah. Anyway, this blew up, and we ended up with like Beckham, Balotelli, like, you know, all these people coming down and partying there. And it turned into this huge night. And then when I was drunk with my friends one night, we just had this idea that we were like, we could actually turn this into a real magazine. So we launched a new business called La Vida Magazine. That was like my first proper company that I started.
What was the concept of the magazine?
So it was like, at this point you've got like Vogue and GQ. And I'm like, well, I'm never going to see people who I know in these magazines because you've got to be an A-list celeb. I'm like, but there is a lot of stuff going on that isn't just celebrities, like the parties we were throwing, but you never get to hear about it. And I'm like, I want to know the best parties in London, the best parties in Liverpool, the best parties in Manchester, but I'm not going to read about them because it's just these A-list celeb shows or whatever. So we were like, we'll do fashion, lifestyle, fitness, music, and we'll just go out there and interview different people.
Just purely from Manchester?
No, all over. Okay. Yeah, so we launched in Liverpool, in Manchester, and in London eventually. And we had like a team of interns who didn't have much money, got our first office in the middle of Manchester. And we were really lucky. We got to interview Meghan Markle, which was like such a random one. I just tweeted her and was like, hey, I love suits. Can I interview you? This was like years before she obviously became who she is now. We got an interview with Drake, Justin Bieber. Like it was strange then, because this is at the time when like Lad Bible had just started, and one of my best friends had launched Social Chain, which was like a really big media company as well. And you would just be able to get access to people a lot easier, especially for interviews. Anyway, I had this idea that if I team up with two people whose parents were rich, I would eventually become rich. So what actually happened is they went out with business cards and told everyone they owned a magazine, and I did all the work and hardly made any money. So after about 2 years of being fed up of not making much money, and with magazines, you're always relying on the print run. So it's like advertising and then the print run. And a lot of the times you're paying for the print run before you get the advertising money. So it's a lot of stress. You're constantly just chasing cash from people.
And how are we distributing the magazine?
So we would just go out and we'd give it away for free.
Okay.
So it would be in every hotel, every spa, every gym, all of the clubs, all of the nice restaurants, all the rest of it. And it was great. Like you got so much, like we could go everywhere for free because we'd feature these places in the magazine. So they'd invite us down. It was a great lifestyle business, but never really made any money. So anyway, I got to a point where I was getting a bit fed up of, you know, not making much money and working my ass off making this magazine. And obviously as well, when you have a business, everyone just thinks you're like suddenly a millionaire for some reason, but they don't realize that you're still broke. And I got an offer. Someone offered to buy the shares off me. This guy that I knew from Kuwait, he really wanted to be part of the magazine. So he bought my shares off me and, you know, effectively allowed me to leave. It wasn't much money, but it was a lot of money to me at the time. It felt like, you know, the most money I'd ever seen. I leave there and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And then I got approached by this guy called Umar, and he was starting a new business. So he just started a new business called Pretty Little Thing, which has obviously become a giant today. And he asked if I wanted to join the team. So I was like the second or third employee there.
Of Pretty Little Thing.
Yeah, we were in like a tiny little office, like literally this size. And it was great. You know, I learned so much. And I was just in charge of design, the brand, the website, and just working a lot of the creative stuff.
What was it like back then? Had the business actually launched at that point?
Yeah, so they were just selling accessories, and then they started to look into how do we do our own clothes and how do we go into, you know, more lines and stuff. So yeah, it was probably one of the best experiences I've ever had, because you had Boohoo behind you and all the knowledge. And
I was going to say, Boohoo was already operational at that point.
Yeah, it was already huge. And his dad, Mahmood, would come in and he would kind of mentor us on like, this is what you need to do to build a huge brand. So it's like, you know, you never get that kind of advice. He was great to work with. Umar was great to work with. And I learned loads from them.
What do you think your biggest one or two lessons or takeaways from that experience?
Do you know what? There's one, and it's actually stuck with me until today, which is just like absolutely anything is impossible. Just don't say no to stuff. Because I think you're always going to be surrounded by people that are constantly going, it won't work, you can't do it. And probably the same in your business, right? The reality is there is a way. You just don't know it yet. There's a person who can solve that problem, or there's a way to compromise on what the problem is. But it can't just be, it'll never work, because that's just taking convention. And convention tells you, oh, you can't do it because someone else says you can't do it and someone else told them they can't do it. But it doesn't mean that it's true. So yeah, just refusing to accept no as an answer and just being relentless in, we will find a way to do it. If it's more money, if it's, you know, we've got to find the right people to bring them in, or we've got to break down what the problem is, there will be a way.
And how long did you stay at Pretty Little Thing for?
So I was there for around 2.5 years.
Okay.
So it was rapid growth. Sort of like from 3 people to like a couple of hundred. And we got this huge office, which I think is still one of their offices today. And that, you know, they were starting to work with lots of celebrities and Kim Kardashian and all the rest of it. And it was really blowing up.
Did your role stay pretty static during that time? Or did you?
It changed quite a bit, because I was basically the design team to begin with. And then, you know, I got to a point where I was hiring different people and building out the creative team. And I'd say, like, not my role became redundant, but definitely when you go from doing everything to guiding other people to do it, you're less on the tools. And I kind of miss that a bit as well, because I like doing the work. I like getting stuck in, and I don't like feeling like I'm removed from stuff.
Why did you leave?
So I just got to a point where, you know, you've always got to look where you're going in your life, haven't you? And, you know, for me, I was like, this was not really my dream to work for like a girls' fashion company. You know, I wasn't passionate about £10 dresses for girls. I like fashion, but it was really like the technology aspect of it, the brand aspect of it, like working with people. And I would always be working with the development teams and the creative team. And that's, you know, the stuff that drew me in. And also, I think with all creatives, trying to trap them under one brand stuff, you know, it's not nice. We want to work with multiple people. We want to have multiple problems. When you've got the same problem you're coming up against every month, it's just not as fun to attack. So I got to a point where I thought, I need to write my own story here, which, you know, I'll be honest, it didn't go down great. You know, that company had done a lot for me, and I'd been there from the beginning. So, you know, I don't think they wanted me to leave at the time. And I really didn't as well. It felt like one of those friction moments where it's like, I could stay here and be happy, but I don't think I'm going to get where I want to get to if I do stay here. So I made the decision, which again, my mum was like absolutely furious about. She was like, what are you doing? It's good to have a stable career. And things were really hard after that, because I was a freelancer. So I'd get a lot of gigs based on the fact that I was at Pretty Little Thing and I'd had La Vida. But things were really difficult in terms of like clients and cash flow. And
So you just went back to being a one-man band freelancer?
Yeah, but more put together, because I'd had a lot more experience at this point. So I was consulting for a lot of other fashion brands. I was helping fashion startups, you know, with the problems they had that had just gone through at Pretty Little Thing. So I knew how to solve a lot of these problems. But yeah, it was tough. And at the same time, one of my best friends, and you know, I don't mind sharing this, but one of my best friends is Steve Bartlett, which is Diary of the CEO. I'm sure most people have heard of him. But Steve is going through this like crazy meteoric rise. So, you know, lots of success
at this point.
So we'd kind of always been working together. And I'm really trying my best to keep up with him, you know, and he's raising millions for his company and social chain's blowing up. And all my friends, everyone was doing quite well. And a lot of them were working in social chain. And I was struggling to keep up, and we're out partying all the time. We're having lots of fun. And I remember I just got to a point where I just made a lot of errors on, you know, I was spending way more money than what I was earning. I was kind of living a life of success without actually having the success. And I must've been 27 at this point, nearly turning 28. And I'm staying with Steve at the time in this like huge mansion, and we're having an amazing time. We've been traveling around the world, doing all this cool stuff, but I didn't have any much money to my name, and everyone thought that I was successful, which is the worst thing, because you start to feel like a bit of a fraud. Mm. And I remember saying to Steve, like, I need to go back to Grimsby, back to my parents. I need to figure some shit out, you know? So I was 27 years old. I just found out the girl that I was dating had cheated on me. And I was like, oh man, it felt like rock bottom. You know, it's like I had debt.
Not as bad as
having
to move back to Grimsby.
Well, Grimsby feels like rock bottom for sure. But it's kind of like a shock to the system that you need. So I get back there. And for the next sort of 6 months, I just decided, you know what? Discipline is what needs to happen here. I need to figure out, how am I, you know, having the same repetitive cycles of, you know, like going out and having fun all the time, but like not really building anything. And as a freelancer, it's hard, you know, and I'm sure to any freelancers listening to this, you are constantly just trading time for money and you're not really building any wealth. You're not really building a business. And if you're sick, you know, you're sick for that week, you're not making any money. And you might even lose a client in the basis of that because they could find someone else. People don't talk about that with freelancers. It's you know, in some ways, it can be harder than running a business because you haven't got anyone helping you. And I remember just being like, you know, I need to find another route for this. I can't just be a freelancer for the rest of my life. So I just sat and planned and I looked at what other agencies were doing. And then I came up with the idea for Noir. And that really was, how can I take the style that I have, which is like a very polished, minimal style, Apple-esque, Nike-esque. You know, I was really good at taking things and building them into, like taking complex problems and building them into really minimal identities that were quite striking, but felt premium. So even if you were a brand new, you know, company that was starting, you already felt established and premium when I was working with them. So that's really how Noir was born. It was like, let's go out there and find and be like the, you know, a secret. Let's not like tell everyone about us, but let's go and speak to individual companies, go in quite cheap, help them build the brand and start to build these really unique brand identities that stand out. And from that, you know, things started to change.
So going back to that word brand then, at this point, were you looking to be more than just a graphic designer? Were you looking to assist with the whole 360 branding package?
Yeah, I mean, so it sort of grew organically. So we first start going in there and we're like, right, what is a brand identity? So, you know, I'd gone from selling these 50-100 quid logos to people need a brand package. Like, what are you going to do with a logo? So it's like, well, we can animate it. We can build these guidelines of how to use it. We can create icons. You know, there was a lot of stationery you'd do back then, business cards and email signatures and stuff. So the package starts to build up and suddenly you go from, you know, sort of like a 50 quid package to, well, if I'm selling a brand to someone, what is that worth to the company? Rather than not, you know, looking at it as how much time have I put into something? It's like, what does that mean to them? What's the impact going to be on that company? If they're turning over, you know, a couple of million a year and that rebrand's going to completely reposition them, well, that's not worth 500 quid. That's, you know, worth 10 grand, even if you didn't spend 10 grand's worth of time on it.
And how were you finding your customers, or where did you find your first customer for this?
Yeah, just super organically, like, you know, and you know, back then as well, like you could message someone on LinkedIn and there wasn't 1,000 people messaging you every day on LinkedIn. So it was quite easy to get in touch with people. I had this trick where, and I still do this today, which is if I want to find someone and they've got a huge network on one platform, I'll go and find a platform where they don't have a huge network on it. So if they're like a huge LinkedIn influencer, but they hardly ever use their Twitter or their Instagram account, I'll find the DMs there because I know that I can cut through the noise and get to them. So I've always tried to find like creative ways of going to pitch to people. And what we used to do then as well is I would start and I would create two or three concepts of someone's logo and tell them what was wrong with theirs and then show them free concepts that I've created.
For free.
Just for free. Yeah. And just say, look, this is what it could be. And that was normally enough for them to go, you're right, my branding is shit. Like, you know, sometimes we would offend people as well because I'd send these audits about everything that was wrong with their company and they would come back and literally be like, go away. Like, we don't care about this kind of stuff. But
I guess you're sorting the wheat from the chaff early in that situation. You know, at least you don't have to waste any more time on them. You know, if they're not going to be your customer, then they're not going to be your ideal customer at any point, are they?
Yeah, definitely.
And tell me, how did you sell your value? So in the context of you know, you're saying that if a company rebrands properly and sees a massive uplift in turnover, profitability, you know, the ROI they get on that, all of a sudden, you know, you're not offering a 500 pound design package, you know, it's a 10 grand rebranding experience, if you like. But I guess, you know, we know that behind the scenes, though, that is the same thing. It's just, you know, you putting a different wrapper on it. But how do you sell that to the customer? Because I know we're talking a bit longer ago than today, but you know, so many businesses today are just, you know, price driven, commodity driven. You know, oh, I want a new logo, I'm going to jump on, you know, Fiverr or People Per Hour, I can get that done for 30 quid, I can get that done for 70 quid, and they don't, you know, they don't see that, you know, that uplift, that value add. I mean, how would you pitch yourself to, you know, to be able to go and get 10 grand for something that someone else could only get 500 quid for?
Yeah, I mean, the simple one is everyone who goes to Fiverr and 99 Designs will be going back to Fiverr and 99 Designs every single year, because a brand doesn't mean anything. It's just a logo, you know. So it's the process. That's what agencies provide. The process of understanding from a research perspective, who actually are you? Not who you think you are, you know, because every CEO will go, I know my business, I know my customers. They don't. It's subjective to them. They've got a certain amount of data points and they've made a bias in their head of what they think it is. But what we do is we come in from the outside and we will ask you, what is your business? What do you stand for? What are your competitors doing? How do we build points of differentiation between that? Obviously, in these early stages of Noir, we weren't doing this so much, but we started to figure out that the research and the strategy is what builds a brand that's going to last for 10 years. That company I mentioned before from Grimsby My Energy, we rebranded them 6 years ago. That they are now the sponsor of Grimsby Town football shirts, which okay. is quite funny looking back on. But
with the same logo,
with the same brand that we created 6 years ago, yeah. And I'll be honest, it's a timeless brand that we created for My Energy. It will still be around in 10, 15 years. And the CEO is a good friend of mine, and she always says to me, she goes, I get people every week asking me, I should change it, I should do this. And she said, just tell me 5 reasons why, and no one can. You know, it's essentially it's a lightning bolt, yeah. But it's quite unique to them. And it's this flow of energy, and it's the community that they're building, and it's like, you know, charging up that community. So there's never any reason to change it, because it's rooted in the research that we did alongside of her team. So everything they told us about the company is built into that entire brand, not just the logo. And once you've done that, it's the brand represents who you are. So like, why would you want to change that? Because that's accurate. That is who we are. That is what we're trying to do. It's how we want to be positioned. But a logo from 99 Designs is really just a logo. It's not a brand. There's no collateral. There's no messaging. It's not, you've not looked at competitors. There's no data points behind it. So that's the major difference.
When did you take your first staff on?
I think we were... probably, so we started back then. I mean, it's probably quite controversial now, but back then when I first started, which was 7 years ago, you could have a lot of interns, and you could pay a couple of £100 a week and they would help you with stuff. So I probably got like 4 or 5 interns at this early stages of Noir. And I had this business partner that I'd teamed up with, a guy called Alex. It's my first business partner. We had 5 or 6 interns, and they were just helping us with parts of the process, but we were really doing everything. So in the very early stages of Noir, I would like wake up in the morning, contact lots of people, go out, pitch to them, come back, write the proposal, send it to them, and then I would start my evening or nighttime of doing the actual work for the other clients. So I'd just be pretty much working like 16, 17 hours a day doing, you know, all of the roles. And then eventually, like, I can remember, it's like a really scary moment. You don't realize it at the time, because when you're working for yourself, you think, if I hire someone, you think of their yearly salary, which is a stupid way to look at it, because they're not saying to you, give me £20,000 right now, because you're looking at the bank account going, we haven't got £20,000. All you really need to think about when you first hire someone is, do I have enough to pay them for the next 3 months? Because if I believe in myself and I know I'm going to get more clients, then we'll get the next 3 months after that, you know. And you can always, it's not nice, but, you know, if it doesn't work out, they're taking a chance on you too. They know you're a startup. Our first hire was a guy called Luke. He was a developer, and he took care of some of the design aspects, but all of the website aspects, which freed up loads of my time. So then I could really go all in on the sales and working on our social media and making sure people got to see our work.
And you mentioned a business partner. So is that someone you took on from the beginning or?
No. So when I was about 3 months in, it was actually my friend Steve had mentioned to me, there's a guy called Alex who used to work for Social Chain. So he'd had an experience working in a startup, and he was like, Alex is really looking for something. He wants to work for himself. And Alex was really good at operations. You know, he's very like attention to detail and good at client management. Like, clients loved him. So when I first start with Alex, fast forward the story, but I'd moved back from Grimsby, from Lincolnshire to Manchester after staying there for like 6 months through this period of just like consolidation, like just figuring out my life. And then when I moved back, I had like a completely different like set of values, which was like, I'm not going to go out and party. I'm not going to hang out with my friends all I'm going to do is just focus on this business. I'm not buying anything. I'm not posting on social media. I'm just going to be completely disciplined and focused. And to make that possible as well, obviously, I didn't have much money. Me and Alex lived together. I remember we went to H&M and bought like 20 black hoodies, got Noir logo printed on them. And that's all the clothes we wore. So it was like, right, this is easy. Don't have to buy any clothes. Don't have to spend any money. And we would just share everything. And it just made it, you know, quite easy to keep costs low. So Alex was great, just got stuck in. Whatever I told him to do, he would just do it. He was just, you know, one of those people that just had a great work ethic. So after, I'd say, 6 months of like this discipline, suddenly we got to a point where we'd gone from a co-working space in the old Granada studios in the center of Manchester to getting our first office in the Northern Quarter, which was probably, yeah, similar to the size that we're in. It was, you know, a smallish office. And we started to hire more people. So I think 6 months in, we were maybe doing, I don't know, 150, 200 grand a year. And we had like 4 staff that were working with us. And we were getting a lot of work. It was all organic. We wasn't really doing much outreach. But every time we did a case study, I would like share it and put it out to people. People would be like, oh shit, that's, you know, that's really good. It's quite different to what's out there. And then we'd get another lead and another lead and another lead. And it felt unstoppable. And then we actually got approached by a guy who wanted to invest in us. Not for much, you know, I think he gave us like 70 grand for 10% or something. But when you're a brand new business, yep. You're just like, wow, like, why would anyone want to give us money? Didn't understand it.
And you did the deal.
Yeah, we did the deal and he came in. But it's kind of like it's a bit of a different type of deal. It was like, we'll give you some money and then we'll give you a bit more money, but we also want some work doing for us. So it's like a property portfolio that he had. And we started working on a few of the property projects for him included within that investment. But it gave us like a bit of a, you know, a boost to like hire some more people and, you know, spend a bit more money on the office and start to try and think about how to build a culture and everything else.
And have you got any horror stories with either this business partner or any other ones or also, you know, the investor you took in? You know, I guess he's reasonably silent. I mean, I get a lot of calls from people saying, you know, I've got this problem with an investor or I've got this problem with a partner. And, you know, and normally they always... they never really come back to exciting legal business issues. You know, it's always down to, you know, personality clashes or, you know, I guess miscommunication that needs resolving in some kind of normal, humane, you know, conversational manner than, you know, than wafting legal letters and stuff around. But, I think for me, anyone who's ever had a partner has, no matter how good those relationships have been, there's always been some kind of problems along the way. Have you got anything you can share with us?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think there's any business that hasn't got one of these stories. So the investor was great. He was a really, really nice guy, really helped us. You know, I think at the time it felt like the best deal. I would never take anyone's money now, especially as a small business, because you have to ask yourself, what do I need the money for?
But it felt like the best deal because you were kind of skint at the time and it was money, it was validation.
Well, when you're first starting, it's all you're doing is just looking at how much money you have in the bank, and we weren't really paying ourselves anything at all. So this was like, you know, that investment was like, oh, fine, I could just take like a couple of grand for myself. You know, I was just sick of eating like rice and sandwiches every day. I was like, you know,
wearing your black hoodie.
Yeah, I'm wearing my same black hoodie every single day. I still carried on wearing it for many years, but it helped us definitely. And it was a signal. It was a signal that we were like doing something right. It's like, this guy wants to invest in us. We're on to something, you know. But yeah, I think the main question with investment is like, what do you need the money for? And if it's cash flow, that's a terrible idea. New business can give you money. You know, like we weren't really, the money we had, if it was to hire more people, it's like, well, you need to go and get more clients. Yep. And then hire more people. Like the money you get from new clients is your investment to hire new people. But I didn't know any of this. And I really didn't know properly how to run a business at this stage. So we get about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half in, and we needed to get a bigger office. So we've like, you know, really pulled out the stops. We'd made a bit of cash. So we went and got like this big office. It's like 1300 square foot or whatever. And we spent, you know, maybe 10, 12 grand, like kitting it all out. And it looked amazing. You know, we got these interior designers working with it, all this stuff that we definitely shouldn't have done, because you know, I think you get excited and there's ego that comes with this as well, where you're like, we want to be the coolest creative agency and we want to be better than our competitors in Manchester, which they didn't matter. We didn't need to think about them. But I was kind of obsessed with like, we need to be the coolest one. And I had this vision for how it needed to look. And we did. We built this amazing office. And then the problem came is we weren't getting as many clients as we were. So cash flow starts to move around. My business partner at the time, Alex, it was just too much for him. He got really, really stressed. And one day I came into the office with his lunch and he just wasn't there. And I was like, where are you? And he didn't reply for like 3 days. And then he was like, I don't want to be in the business anymore. And that was it. He'd gone to Newquay where his family were and he never came back after that.
Wow.
So then...
Have you been in contact since?
Yeah. I mean, it was a really difficult time because when you've like, you know, we were living together, we were working together, we were like, you know, in the trenches together. And then he took a bit of cash out the account with like without speaking to me about it, and that was like people's wages, and it just got really, really messy. And then I realized like that we just did not understand how VAT worked, and we didn't have enough. We were like going into our VAT fund to pay some wages, and we were like, you know, trying to play that game of not separating the funds, and like the only thing you need to do in business is just put your money to VAT to one side and don't look at it, and then at the end of the year if you've got enough back, that's a bonus that goes back in the account. I wish I knew that at the time. So we start getting behind on payments for stuff. Then I had this client that tried to sue us because he'd lost his investment. So then he was like trying to scrape money together. So we had to pay for like these court fees. And
this was the investor?
No, this was a client that we had. He'd lost his investor.
Okay.
And he was opening up a series of gyms. So he decided to try and sue everyone he'd worked with on the gym to try and reclaim some of the money back, because he'd spent the first phase of the investment on all of these people to work on the project for him. Which, you know, like, you know, I don't hold anything against him now, but for us, when I was already having like, you know, the VAT problem piling up, people's salaries, my business partner leaving, it literally felt like, you know, my world was crashing down. And there were just so many nights where I'd be sat in the office, you know, till 2-3 a.m. in the morning, and I would just be like, I just don't know how I'm gonna do this. I don't know how I'm going to get more money. Like, even if I go out there and win 10 more clients, I don't know how we're going to be able to pay this. And the debt's piling up and I'm just thinking, what am I doing this for? You know, like, I'm not making any money. Like, everything I'm doing is just to pay everyone. And I'm like, this is going to collapse. And then things got worse. Then that old business partner, Alex, he takes a job at another agency and he puts out a press release. At this point, I've not told our clients and I've not even told all of the team, because I was like, you know, I need to kind of like figure out how I'm going to put this message out there. And the problem is when you tell your story online, you open yourself up for other people to peer into your life. So, you know, if you build your business quietly, no one will look into your business. But if you build it publicly, people are always waiting to see if you're going to fail. And so this article comes out. We have like, you know, an exodus of clients going, what's happening at Noir? Do we need to like stop this project? Are you guys going to be able to complete it? Why is your business partner left? Why is he announced at a new company? I'm just like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. Anyway, I keep working and working and working and trying to get out of it. And I'm, you know, pulling together new clients. The staff are like getting pretty worried at this point because they can see that I'm stressed. I must have looked like shit as well because I was probably sleeping like 3 hours a night. And then I got to a point where I just went and spoke to a liquidator and I was like, what are my options here? I've got this VAT bill piling up. I've got the office rent, which is huge. You know, I've got a bunch of clients that have not paid us. I've got these court fees that I paid to win against this guy who's trying to sue us, which we won in the end. But it you know, it must have cost us a fortune, you know, to get to that point just to win this case against him, and all of that time and energy as well. Essentially, what happened is I spoke to the liquidator and he said, what we can do is we could do something called like a pre-pack administration, where you can close down the company and you can sell this into like a new entity, and this will clear a lot of your debts off and this will help you be able to like relaunch under something else. So I'm like, well, that sounds like a good idea. It's not really what I want to do. I don't want to fail. You know, I had it in my head, like, I can't fail. And at the time of all of this as well, there's one major part I missed out is we keep winning awards. were constantly winning awards. So, you know, there's all these articles going out about Noir's success. So it was a similar story to like what happened when I was like 27 and everyone thinks you're successful. Everyone's saying, congratulations, what you've done at Noir is amazing. But at the same time, I'm looking at you know, the bank balance and I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to pay people, let alone pay myself all these debts. So anyway, I got to a point where I was like, I'm going to have to sort of close down the company. So I start to go through this process of the pre-pack administration and launching under a new entity. And then someone like sees what's going on, someone from outside. So they release this article just like absolutely slamming me, like he's a monster, like claiming all this success.
Who's this someone?
Just this random reporter. And he just decided to pick on me. And he released this article. It was something like, you know, the business awards are a joke. And it had a photo of me at the front of it. And this shit just went viral. And I was like, oh my God, this is like the last thing that anyone wants in their life. And I never realized how horrible it is to hear lots of people discussing something about you when they don't know what's really going on. So yeah, this is like all over the internet. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then, you know, my team are asking me all these questions. And it was just a really, really tough time. Again, I would say that was like one of the hardest things I've ever gone through.
And were you trading in the new business at this point?
We'd not even done the pre-pack thing. Yeah. We just started to go through the process of it. But when you do that, to liquidate a company, you list it on like the Gazette something. And like someone had picked up on it and at the same time seen we were winning these awards. So they were like, oh, he's a fraud. He's winning awards. And, you know, like, we can't slam people for failing in business. It's like, it's part of the process. Like there's not really many entrepreneurs out there that haven't gone through something really, really difficult with either cash flow or, you know, like, you know, a business partner leaving or investment pulled or whatever it is. Like business is hard. But at the time, the narrative was just like, I was like just this monster that was like parading ourselves as winning these awards while struggling in the background. But I'm like, no one ever comes out and goes, oh, we haven't got much revenue coming in at the moment and we're really struggling with debt. Like, I've never seen that as a LinkedIn post in my life. You know, people only talk about the things that they're doing well, which is obviously a problem as well. You know, people should talk about when things are hard. But the connotation of if I post things are really hard right now is like you're going to lose clients.
Yep.
You're not going to gain clients by saying things are tough, you know.
You did the pre-pack in the end. You did the
so yeah, we ended up doing the pre-pack, but what we ended up doing is instead of starting a new entity, we sold the Noir brand. We packaged up the whole brand and sold it to a company which was a partner of mine. So they were a marketing agency called Roto, and that became Noir. And then I sort of like sat in the background, you know, still running the company, but as more like an advisory role, just because you have to do that. And then, yeah, I you know, we relaunched Noir, but we changed it. It wasn't the same business.
And how was that feeling for you? Because, you know, so I've been bankrupt personally. I've, you know, liquidated businesses over the years. And it's something that, you know, people always come to me for advice on. And normally the narrative put around bankruptcy, put around that business going into liquidation is always very, you know, don't do it, avoid it at all costs. You know, when you go bankrupt, your life's going to be over. But the analogy I always give is I talk about a cancer patient and basically say that, you know, if you've got somebody who's dying of terminal cancer, you know, that the life is horrendous. You know, they're going to, whatever it is, months, years of chemotherapy, of radiotherapy, of feeling like shit, of being in and out of hospital, of knowing ultimately that they are going to die. And at the point that they die, it's probably a blessing to them. You know, it's an end to all these problems, and you know, they can, you know, move on to a better world and leave everything behind them. And I liken that very much, you know, to the situation of failed businesses or personal debts that lead to bankruptcy. Because, you know, when people go, oh, but if you go bankrupt, your credit's going to be fucked. your credit already is well fucked. You know, if you're actually at the stage of talking about, you know, maybe needing to look at bankruptcy, you've suffered months, if not years, of red letters, of unpaid bills, of not being able to pay your staff, of not sleeping, of not eating, of not being able to do anything you really probably want to do financially, and that point, that moment of bankruptcy comes, and it's, you know, if anything, it's a relief. You know, you're drawing a line on those problems, and yes, that doesn't mean tomorrow's going to be a walk in the park. It's not, you know, you're starting from zero and you're building back up again. But at least you are going to zero. You're being able to walk away from all those stresses that ultimately are just continuing to pull you down. And yes, you know, people always want to say, well, I don't want to get, you know, morally, I want to be able to keep my head held high and say I never went bankrupt. But I mean, ultimately, if you've got, for argument's sake, 100 grand of income and 10 million quid of the debts, it doesn't matter how fucking high you want to hold your head, you know, you're never ever going to be able to fix that position. So at some point you've got to bite the bullet and take your medicine. But how was it for you? You know you've talked about sleeping 3 hours a night, you know, not eating properly, not being comfortable with the staff. I mean, what was it? Was it a relief? Were you scared? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, failure is just like a really difficult thing, because I think as any business owner, there's an element of ego that you have. There's a story that you tell yourself every day, and it feels like, you know, you've failed in that. It was really, really hard. And I didn't actually deal with really the problems of what, like, emotionally I was going through until actually like maybe 6 months after, when it actually hit me and I started getting like these panic attacks and feeling like super anxious about stuff. And I had no idea, because it was like a physical feeling, you know, not like in my head. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I've always kind of been pretty much like, every day is a new day. You know, I'm always very positive about everything, but my body had actually gone like, no, like you need to deal with the stress. But yeah, at the time, you know, it feels like, you know, your world is over, and especially hearing anyone else talk about you. You know, I remember there was like some of my mum's friends, they were talking to my mum about like, oh, are you not disgusted that he owed this money, like VAT? And I remember just being like, this is just so strange, because like companies go bust all the time and no one's ever looking and being like, oh, these horrible people. And I think we had like maybe 35 grand debt in VAT. It wasn't like millions, you know, I wasn't like trying to rob people. It was just, I didn't know how to run a business properly. I didn't have enough experience. So when this article comes out, I then write a reply to it. And, you know, I basically just held my hands up and said, like, these are all the mistakes that I made that led to where we are today. You know, all I want to do is like build a great company, work in the creative industry, build beautiful brands and make our clients happy. And I think we've done that, you know, in terms of like all of our clients. We didn't have anyone who was really unhappy, apart from the guy who tried to sue us to get his money. But everyone was happy. All of our clients had done amazing work. Our team loved what we were doing. I'm like, so I did everything that I wanted to do. I just didn't know how to run a business. I didn't know how to balance all the books. I didn't know what would happen if our revenue changed month on month. I'd never experienced these things before. So I put out an article that said that. And fortunately, the internet piled back in and said, we're right with you. And a lot of prominent CEOs from huge companies got in touch with me, and they told me a story of when they'd failed and their first business idea had like not worked. And they were saying like, you know, this is a battle scar. This is going to teach you everything you need to know. This is going to humble you in a way you've never been humbled, but you cannot give up because you have a great talent. And no one can argue that the work you've done is so much better than a lot of the people that are out there. So don't quit. That's the signal that you need. And that was amazing to hear that, you know, that was like just pure energy, like they're right, you know, like I think Richard Branson had like 7 liquidations or something. So it's like there clearly is a reason why people fail. And it's like you never learn if you don't fail. You know, it's like a little kid, what was that great quote? Like if you're a little kid and your kid falls over, you don't say to him, that's it, give up walking now. Yep. You don't need to walk ever again. Then you just go get back up again. And that's the same with business. You have to keep going. And it fundamentally changed me as a person, because when we relaunched Noir 2.0, we'll call it, we changed the business. We removed the ego from it. We removed, like, you know, overshouting. We didn't partake in any awards whatsoever, because we're like, we don't need someone else to tell us that we're doing well. And, you know, we really thought about the whole process of like, how do we build a scalable model? And the good thing is I'd partnered with this guy, Jamie, who's my business partner today, and he's incredible.
And this was the guy who had the marketing agency.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'd actually, Jamie had come to me like a couple of years before, and he was thinking of setting up this like paid social media agency. And he'd worked it for big agencies, but he wanted to go out on his own, and he was asking me for advice. So we'd met for a coffee, stayed in touch, and kind of mentored him a little bit on the steps that he needed to go through. And then when all this happens, me and Jamie were already in these conversations about kind of like merging our skills together, because the thing with agency world is in branding, it's projects, and in marketing, it's retainers. So, you know, there was a clear problem. So, you know, for a branding agency, you're getting these big ticket items, but they're sporadic with their revenue. You know, that you might make 50 grand one month and 20 grand the next month. But with the marketing retainers, it's like 8 grand every single month. So it's very scalable and you've got the cash flow coming in. But on the marketing side, because it's retainers, you're not getting these huge projects. So you don't get that huge amount of cash flow through. But combined together, that meant that we would always have this running cash flow come through from the retainers, but we'd also have access. And it helps throughout the process. We were launching these brands and then we would disappear. And that was really bad because you couldn't keep the connection with the client. Whereas if they then turned into a retainer after a project, it was just a great model. So we start with this and we really redefine how we're doing it. And as we're building these brands, because of the team that Jamie had already put together, he had all these key marketing people where when we built a website, we could focus much more on conversion. And it was set up for the marketing campaigns that would come after that.
And what did his business trade? Was he called Noir at that point then, or did you drop the Noir name?
So he was called Roto, yeah. And then we sort of became Noir. We traded under, changed the name and relaunched on things because we'd obviously built up like a great reputation with what we were doing.
And how does that bring us to out here now? When did you leave England and why?
Yeah, so a lot happened after that. We really changed the foundations of the business and we invested quite a lot of money into that research and strategy part because we believe like without that, those insights at the beginning, everything you're doing is subjective, like style and, you know, what's cool right now. And it's like, if you're following trends, you're never setting them. So if you do the research, you can start to set trends and you can start to build points of differentiation, which builds unique brands and unique campaigns. So we get to 2020, we're doing pretty good. I think we were making maybe 600,000-700,000 a year at this point. The team's growing quite well. Everything's going nicely. We're getting access to great projects. Huge tech companies are getting in touch with us. We're rebranding for businesses that maybe had like 150 staff and they'd been going for maybe 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, really good, high caliber, high ticket clients. And then COVID hits. And just like every single agency, we're all like, this is the end. All of our retainers cancel. All of our projects get paused. We've got this huge team and we don't know how we're going to pay for anything. We're still having to pay for our office as well. They didn't give us any break on that. They're like, nope, still want the money. You can come in if you want. We were like, well, we're being told not that we can't come in. And I remember it was, I think it was around the end of March, April time. And we'd put, you know, a lot of our team on furlough and we were working remotely. And I rang up my business partner. I said, look, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think I'm done with Manchester. The only reason why I stayed here all these years is because we had the office here and we had the team here. So I think I want to leave. And he's like, this is a strange time to talk about leaving. We're in the lockdown. And I said, yeah, but if we're going to work remotely, then I could work remotely anywhere. So why am I staying in Manchester, paying for this apartment, paying for this office, all this stuff we're doing? I was like, we're trapping ourselves with overheads. We don't know what's going to happen. We've still got a bit of money coming in. So I said, what's important to you? And he said, I really want to get a mortgage. He goes, I want to get a mortgage and I want to get married. And I said, okay, well, what's important to me is I want to get out of here. I don't want to get out of Noir, but I want to get out of Manchester. I've been in this place for more than a decade. I think that I've exhausted my resources here. I don't feel like I'm moving forward. So I said, I'll make you a deal. I said, we will make sure that you have enough money coming to put down, for a mortgage, put down a deposit and get a house and be able to, you know, plan your wedding. I said, but I need you to have my back because I'm going to leave. I'm going to sell everything I own. and I'm going to leave. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm going to leave on Sunday. And he's like, what? You know, you can't leave on Sunday. I said, this was like Tuesday. And I'm like, I've already thought about it. I spoke to my landlord. They said I can get out of my contract. I spoke to the office landlord. We can get out of the contract there. I'm going to go. And he's like, where are you going to go? You're not allowed to fly. And I said, I'm going to try and go to Portugal, because I've heard that if you go to the airport, from a few people that I know, that they'll just let you in because no one knows the rules right now. So I did. I sold everything. Portugal? I've been to Lisbon once before, yeah. And I was like, this is a cool city. You know, it feels kind of like California, but it's on the same time as the UK. And also at the time, they didn't have as many restrictions. So slightly controversial, but you could still eat in restaurants there and you didn't have to wear a mask everywhere. And it was sunny, and Manchester is never sunny. In case you've ever been there, it just rains pretty much every day. So yeah, within a few days, I'd sold absolutely everything and off I was. And I flew over to Lisbon. And I stayed there for maybe 6-7 weeks. And then I waited.
Just in an Airbnb or something?
Yeah, and everything was super cheap. So I think my flight was like £30 or something at the time. And then, yeah, the hotel that I was staying at was, I think it was around like £800 a month. It was super cheap. It was like, you know, cheaper than renting an apartment, because there was no one in it. And I stayed in Lisbon, and I was working from my laptop there, and we started to pick up some more clients. And then I just continued. So then Lisbon got a little bit more stricter. So I went over to Marbella, stayed in Marbella for a month. Then that got a bit stricter. So I went over to Italy, Barcelona, Madrid, Turkey. And then I think that brings us up to like why I ended up coming to Dubai. So,
and had you been to Dubai before at this
point? Never. And it wasn't the kind of place that I wanted to move to. Everything I'd seen was like a soulless, man-made concrete jungle, you know, all of the things people say about Dubai. And all I'd seen is like Five Palm. And Five Palm is the worst representation of Dubai. I was like, they're not the kind of people I want to be around. You know, that's not for me. I like really nice, like high-end, classy restaurants, like everyone dressed nice, not full of chavs everywhere. And I was like, this is not my place. This is full of people with bad values. Anyway, I'm in Turkey and someone tagged me in a tweet and he said, I'm looking for the best branding agency in the world to help build a new type of VC, a crypto VC. And my friend tagged me and he was actually like a partner at that company. And he just tagged me to see if I was interested. I jump on a call with them and I think I was either in Mykonos or Turkey at the time. And we start chatting and I'm pitching. And I remember the CEO goes to me, you're hungover, aren't you? And I went, a little. And he goes, I am too. I'm dying. And anyway, we just started having a laugh. And he was like, it was a really good pitch considering you're hungover. And I said, well, you know, I wouldn't have noticed you are. Anyway, me and him get chatting. He tells me about this idea that he's got to build this like venture capital firm. And, you know, no one had really solely invested in crypto projects at this point. There wasn't many like VCs that were doing that. Some people who were dipping their toes in. And he said, I really want to help you to help us build the brand. And I'm going to give you quite a lot of money to be able to do it because it needs to be amazing. And he goes, and then we're going to partner together. If this all goes well, I want you to help me with all these other companies. He goes, but what I need is I need you to get on a flight tomorrow. And I said, what do you mean? And I'm in Turkey at the time. And he's like, I need you to get on a flight because I booked this huge yacht in Dubai and I've invited like 100 of like the biggest influencers in Web3 and I want you to meet them all. I think it'll be a great opportunity for you. I said, well, I did think about coming there, but it was going to be in a couple of weeks. And he goes, mate, just get here. So I go straight to the airport. I think I landed here at like 5 a.m. or something like that. And then at 9 a.m., half past nine, I'm down at the marina and I'm ready to get on this yacht. And I don't know anyone. I just spoke to the CEO, which is called Charles, like, you know, the day before. We'd signed our engagement and, you know, we were going to build his brand for this VC. And I get on the boat and it's just full of people launching projects. Nearly every one of those people on the boat became a client in some form or introduced us to one. Anyway, as part of the process that I discussed with you, as we do this like deep research into what we're doing. And I'd always held, you know, a bit of crypto and kind of been interested in it, but I didn't really understand it properly. The more I start like going through this like deep dive into the world of Web3 and crypto and how blockchain enabled tech is going to change everything we're doing, the more I was like, this is what we need to be doing. Because like branding is solving problems. And crypto is one of the biggest problems. No one understands it. No, and these projects are super technical, brand new technology, but they can't articulate to their customers what they're doing, which is perfect for us because that's like the type of client that we want to work with.
So when you approach a branding project for a crypto business or, you know, or AI or anything like that, do you come at it from a different viewpoint that you would a traditional business or bricks and mortar business?
In some ways, it depends on the type of business that there is. So we kind of have this layered approach that will go for quite a few businesses. So say if they're like an extended reality project, like a metaverse project. Mm. Well, metaverse projects don't just live as a brand online. You know, it's not like an e-commerce business. It's not like a bricks and mortar shop. And it's not like a tech company. So they're going to be building layers on AR, digital assets, virtual reality. So you have to start to look at the positioning of how you talk to all these different people. Now, the process is pretty much the same in terms of the research, like ask a lot of questions, get a lot of data points. But the beautiful thing about Web3 is that companies actually have a community. We always throw this word around community. Most people will call their social media following their community. But if those people aren't actually communicating with you, they're just a social media follower. They're not your community. Yeah. In Web3, people are buying your token. They become like, you know, a stakeholder of your business, a shareholder in your business. And they are looking at everything that you're doing and you can engage with them and you can talk to them. So from a branding perspective, we actually get to see like, why have you invested in this company? What is it that was attractive to you? And we can figure out, you know, like reverse engineer what it is that makes people want to invest in different technology companies. What are sort of the pain points? What is being solved here as a problem? And when you're building these brands, you're kind of like a public company. You're looking at the native early adopters. So like who are the people, the crypto natives that are using these products? And then also who are the VCs? How are we going to help them raise more money? The team that they're going to hire, how do we make this company feel very attractive to grab all of the young talent there is around? And then also like institutional investors and then your newbies. So people, you know, normal people that don't understand Web3, how do we onboard them to want to use this project? So there's like lots of different types of users. Whereas like a typical tech B2B, you might just be looking at like the person who's yep. going to use the platform, you know, and then it's normally a sales rep. So you're building it and the pitch deck to be able to sell to a lot of these people.
And who is the business now? Is it still you and your partner that was back in England, or did this VC that you were that dragged you over to Dubai, did he get involved in the business in some way as well then?
So I became one of the partners at his venture capital firm right. called Rarestone, and we partnered Noir and Rarestone together. Okay. So everything that Rarestone invested in pretty much got brought over to Noir, and we would work on like the meat and bones, like who are you and how do we articulate this to the world? We'd build these brands so that all the things they invested in would, you know, hugely grow in the value purely based off the fact that they looked like crap to begin with and no one understood what they did, but they'd raised millions of dollars to a brand that looked extremely established, but maybe had only been around for 3 months, but looked as good as like Apple and, you know, these big tech companies and stuff that are out there.
And have you gotten involved in any of these projects yourself?
Yeah, so that was the major difference is we started to change Noir to become more like a brand venture studio because all of these companies were offering us either equity within their business or tokens as like a form of payment. So nearly all the projects we got invested in, we would invest in and build their brand. And also that meant that we actually had a bit of skin in the game. So we could continue to work with these clients. And like many of our clients that we have today, we own, like we hold equity within their company and we hold tokens as well. And we haven't sold any of them. And that keeps us connected because everything we're building is like working towards, we're all part of the same team rather than just being this agency, you know, on a production line. It's like, there's your brand, there's your website, off you go on to the next one. So it fundamentally changed everything that we do. But yeah, so we still have the company in the UK, and then we obviously have the company in the UAE as well. And yeah, I've been here for 3 years now. So.
And have you got any staff over here?
Yeah, a couple. But to be honest with you, we kept one. I mean, the beauty of remote work, I mean, there's definitely some upsides and some downsides. You know, the downside is obviously that you're not all in an office together and you can't like, you know, really grind down on ideas. And I do think that like being physically present in the same place changes your business. But the upside is you're no longer hiring talent based on a radius of where your office is, which is just stupid anyway, because there's so much talent all over the world. Unfortunately as well, the Web3 industry, nearly every single brand that we work with, they are a global remote team. So it's become so normal now after COVID that everyone we talk to, it's like there's, you know, one of their members of staff is in Taiwan and the other one's in San Francisco and the other one's in New York.
Are you hiring full-time staff or do you just have lots of freelancers around the world that you work with then?
No, that mainly full-time staff, yeah. So we've got like, I don't know, like maybe 40-odd full-time staff. And then we have people that we bring in, like specialists, that if we want to work like on a bigger project, we'll bring in like, you know, an amazing motion designer or, you know, a team of developers that we might bring on a project as well. And we kind of flex and change depending on the size of the project. But the team are everywhere. They're no longer like restricted to one place.
And in terms of some specific projects, I think you're involved in an AI project called RingFans.
Yeah, so that's actually a company that I'm a founder of as well. So
is that something that's come out of this kind of incubation process, or is that?
So it's actually with a couple of different CEOs that I'd worked with on their own projects, we decided to pull together a team for this idea that we had, which is basically mixing Web3 and AI together. I don't know how much you played around with generative AI. So you can kind of type something in and it will create an image.
What's it called? Midjourney.
Like, yeah.
So I don't use it personally, but some of the guys on my team use it. I've seen it in action and it's very fancy.
Yeah, and it's only going to get better. I mean, there's been tools that have released like recently where you can upload a video and just remove elements of the video and you can turn images into videos. It's like there's so much stuff, and it's like I said, it's only going to keep getting better and better. But there's a huge problem with it. Any of these creation tools, there's no intellectual property attached to them at all. So as a brand, if you want to use any of these tools, you're going to be breaking intellectual property and copyright rules. So what we've done is we've built an engine that allows you to create these different images, but also you can use your own images as a data point. So if you've taken a load of photographs and, you know, maybe it was a piece of art or it's some buildings that you shot, and then you wanted to create more work that was quite similar to that, or, you know, remove elements using AI or whatever it was, you could load them into this engine and it would essentially ring fence your images and stop them being used by other engines. Okay. But then it also allows you that anything you produce, you can then digitize it. So you can essentially turn it into an NFT and then you can sell that to other people. Or one of the most amazing things that we've created from it is if someone else uses your images that you've created, that you've shared on our open marketplace as a data point, you will actually get paid for them using your artwork, which is, you know, something that's brand new and it's a huge problem that no one's been able to solve at the moment. We're in early stages.
So you're not up and running yet.
We're at like MVP stage. So, you know, we're building the product. We've raised like $500,000, just like pre-seed. We'll eventually launch a token. You know, we need to go through quite a few more rounds and, you know, it's going to be an expensive gig building the product, but it's the MVP is pretty much there and we're going to be launching this really soon.
Exciting. And what's next? What's the next iteration of Noir, or what's next for you yourself?
Yeah, so I mean, we're all in on the Web3 space now. So from that really early stage where we started going down the rabbit hole to where we are now, we only work within sort of the Web3 and AI space. So emerging technology really is probably the right umbrella to define it. So that's kind of like renewable energy companies, these extended reality, so virtual reality, augmented reality, because I think that's going to be huge over the next couple of years. Some of the gaming companies, DeFi, so decentralized finance, and still some fintech companies, a lot of marketplaces, and then the Web3 space in general. As we approach like what's coming up now is another bull run by the looks of things. And I think that's really, you know, going to change and pull the industry forward. We've got rid of a lot of the bad actors within the space. And now, you know, everything's becoming quite legitimized. So we're just going to keep working with amazing teams, investing in them really early and helping them grow. And that's pretty much, you know, the goal. And while we're doing that, we're going to run like a bit of an incubator for different ideas and start investing in lots of companies. Jamie and I have invested like nearly $1 million over the last couple of years now in lots of projects.
In tech-related projects?
But pretty much all Web3, yeah, as equity or as tokens within the business.
Well, on a completely unrelated note, I can't let you go without asking about your alcohol-free journey as well, which I think I'm right in saying that you've given up booze recently.
Yeah.
Is it recently?
Or? Yeah, yeah. From January the 1st, nearly a year now coming up.
A very good mate of mine who's actually also got a design agency who lives out here and he does all my stuff actually.
Is it Jamie?
Jamie.
I know Jamie from Manchester.
Oh, really?
So we spoke a few times about this. Yeah.
Okay. So Jamie's been free from the 1st of January as well, actually. So
yeah, he's a good guy. To be honest with you, I just got to a point where I kind of had this theory in my head that we're all kind of playing around between, if you think of energy as like a percentage, we're all kind of like getting to the point where we're, I don't know, let's say we start with 100% energy and then you go out and have a drink and you get pretty blasted. You wake up the next day, you're at like 40, 50% energy. You make bad decisions from that, right? So you don't go to the gym that day. You normally eat like, you know, burgers and shitty food. And then it normally leaks into the next day. So in order to return to 100% energy, you would not have to really drink again for probably around 2 or 3 weeks, because you always feel a little bit of it, because it's like your sleep gets affected, your diet gets affected, your energy gets affected, and you just go through this repetitive cycle of never really returning to 100% energy. And I just started thinking, well, I wonder what I would achieve if I was always at like 100, or at least I was living between 100% and 80%, you know, depending on if I'd had bad food or I didn't get great sleep. And then also, I think I just got to a point where I'm like, I partied all over the world. Like, you know, I've got blackout drunk. I've had so much fun. I'm 36 now, but at the time I was 35. And I just thought, maybe there's another way to do this. You know, what are the reasons that I have a drink? And I really started to look into that. And I think that's the most important part for anyone that's interested, is like, why do you drink? And for me, I'm like, you know, there's loads of reasons why people drink, especially with British culture. It's like you drink when you're happy, you drink when you're sad, you drink when you're stressed. Like, you drink to have confidence, to talk to people, to be yourself when you're out in public, you know. And I just started thinking, all these things feel a bit broken. Maybe I should try and fix what's underneath them. So if I can fix my confidence, if I can be happy being somewhere where everyone else is drinking and I'm not, then if I fix that, that's no longer a problem. So then if I decide to drink, it's because I like to have a drink. It's not because I'm trying to solve a problem that I have or cut off and relax from something.
So are you going to go back to drinking?
No, not now. Yeah.
As in, you think you are done?
100%. I for me personally, I don't care if anyone drinks. It means nothing to me. You know, I'm not preaching that everyone needs to quit drinking. For me, it was the right decision. I am 100 times better as a person in my discipline, my focus, my productivity, my mood, you know, how I react to things, everything. I would say like my central nervous system is just like peace all the time. And I wouldn't want to disrupt that. So it started off just as like, let's just do this for a few months, become super healthy and just see how I feel, to the point of realizing that I never needed it. And actually, you know, if I'd have carried on, I would never have solved the problems that I've solved over the last 6 to 8 months or so. And I feel like a completely different person to who I was before last year. So I'm like coming up to this next new year. And I'm like, you know, I'm sure you've had the same similar experience, right? You ever been in a club where it feels like everyone is just having sort of like paid fun, fake fun? You know, it's like everyone's getting smashed. One of your mates has had way too much. So he's like falling all over the place, saying shit he should not be saying. You know,
I mean, so I've never been a big drinker, right? I love red wine. Never really liked the taste of booze. I mean, as a kid, my kind of go-to, I say kid until about 38, my go-to has always been Smirnoff Ice, or, you know, Iron Brew WKD.
Well, that brings you back.
something like that. I think I was an older demographic that they never actually planned for in the marketing plan. But I've never been a big drinker. I completely get behind, you know, many people quitting. I'll happily say I'll never quit, because I don't really have anything to quit from. I mean, like, you know, like in the last 2 months, I've probably drunk 6 glasses of wine. That is my total alcohol consumption. But I don't have a problem that I need to fix. Therefore, I'm not going to put I'm not going to put like a finite thing on something. You know, like I know I love my red. I also am acutely aware of the fact that if I have more than half a bottle, then I'm going to wake up feeling 100 years old tomorrow, and therefore, you know, we'll do it either never or very, very infrequently. But I can't stand drinkers. like I look at people boozing, and for me, you know, male or female, and it's funny how we change our views as we get older, isn't it?
Definitely.
You know, like as we were kids, when we were kids, we're like, I've got to get those birds fucked up so we can shag them, you know. And now I look at a drunk bird, and I don't find anything more unattractive than a drunk woman. I mean, it's just for me, you know. And again, it's not me preaching. I'm not saying don't ever drink. But you know, just the fucking mess you look like, and then the knock on effect on the days after. And the guys, you know, again, just the same. You know, I mean, WhatsApp groups of various birthday parties that I've ultimately not gone to because I just can't be arsed standing around 30, 40, 50 people. Getting smashed, you know, the booze leads to the gear leads to whatever's fucking next, and it's just not for me. Now that said, I'll never quit because I want my red wine, but it's just a horrible place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it really does come back to that why, you know, when I see people who are like absolutely wasted weekend after weekend, there's normally something that they're avoiding. And what happened to me is after around 3 months of not drinking, I always describe it to my friends sort of like looking in the mirror, you know, it really felt like a moment where I saw myself quite differently. My training got really, really good and I lost about 9 kg. Just purely, and I wasn't even a big drinker, but I think it was all the things that came after drinking, like the diet and the sleep and the not training properly.
Well, I mean, it just goes on, doesn't it? The calories of the booze, knocked onto the fact you don't train properly the next day, knocked onto the fact that you would rather eat a McDonald's than a salad, you know, to feel better. And, you know, if you say that, I don't know, the calorific cost of a bottle of wine is, I don't know, 800-900 calories, the true calorific cost of that is probably 5,000 calories. When you play it out with all the knock on effects, and definitely a lost day in the gym is a bare minimum.
I saw something the other day, and it said going out and getting drunk tonight is borrowing happiness from tomorrow. It's like you've got to pay for it. You get extra happiness or whatever, and you feel like you're having fun with everyone, but the next day you're going to be low. And the knock on effect, like you said, the steps that come after it, they're the problem, I think. But from like a productive point of view as well, you know, I have this theory that like, you know, your whole reality is purely based on the story that you tell yourself every day. You know, so if you wake up and you decide that, you know, you're a fucking winner and like you will not accept anything but that, you're going to build a great company, you are meant to be where you are, you are meant to be doing what you're doing, you know, then you will. You will make actions every day and steps to take that will do that. The problem with getting, you know, being hungover, not even being drunk, but being hungover quite frequently, is it's very easy to start to tell yourself that you're the person who's late, you're the person who's not reliable, you're the person who goes, oh, I can't bother to do that today. You know, it's the difference between waking up and jumping out of bed and getting on with the thing you're meant to be doing, even if it's boring as hell, or going, oh, do you know what, I'm so hungover, I'm just not doing anything today. And I wonder how many of those I can't be bothered today start to change, you know, the reality and the story you tell yourself over time. And I've spent, you know, I'll be honest with you, it's been quite a mind altering experience just from that initial decision to stop drinking to all of the thoughts I've had after and all of the realizations I've had about who I am as a person and like the story that I tell myself. And I genuinely feel like a completely different person coming nearly a year later now. And that's why for me, I'm like, this new person doesn't ever need to drink. So for me, it's just absolutely no point. I also love red wine, especially with steak. It's amazing. But the principle of it, it doesn't make sense to me to change or alter my state of mind when I'm so happy being who I am. Perfect. It's like, why would I change it, you know?
Well, I'll let you smell a glass of mine one day. Listen, Anthony, it's been a pleasure having you here, mate. You know, it's been a great, great journey. And I guess you're only 36 years in. So hopefully we can do a round two at some point in a couple of years time. And we can listen to how some of these web projects have played out. And you can tell me more about life in Dubai and life off the booze. But before you go, just give yourself a little shout out so people know where to find you, where to follow you, and where they can come and get you if they want some work.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, if you're for a starter, if you're, you know, a web free company, or, you know, you're building within the space and you really need some help, you know, I have all of the contacts to be able to do that, from raising money to building the brand, building the community, and launching your marketing. We have pretty much partners across the board for all of these parts of the process. And I'm actively investing in companies all the time. So please reach out to me in my inbox. If you want to follow me on Instagram, it's at Anthony Scott Logan. Our website for Noir Ventures is just noir.io. So noir.io.
Perfect. Anthony, thanks again, buddy.
Thank you very much. Cheers, man.